What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1938, Louis Armstrong, Fats Waller, Jack Teagarden, and Bud Freeman rolled into this rendition of On the Sunny Side of the Street for live radio. Like many other great performances of that day, it would typically have been broadcast and gone. But it wasn't. It isn't. An audio engineer and jazz enthusiast named Bill Savory recorded it and buried it away with nearly 1,000 other off-the-radio recordings for decades. Now the National Jazz Museum has acquired that remarkable collection and pulled it from the shadows. It's a treasure of great in-the-moment performances from Benny Goodman, Billie Holiday, Count Basie, Herschel Evans, Coleman Hawkins, and many, many more that have not been heard since the height of the swing jazz era. But we're hearing it now. This hour On Point, we're diving into the Savory collection. You can join the conversation, swing jazz fans. Does it feel like time travel to hear this sound, like magic to hear it again? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Lauren Schoenberg, Executive Director of the National Jazz Museum in Harlem. He spent decades chasing the Savory collection. Now he's finally got it. He's also a jazz historian and author of the NPR Curious Listener's Guide to Jazz. Lauren Schoenberg, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
And with us from New York as well is Michael Cogswell, longtime director of the Louis Armstrong House Museum in Queens. He spent some time already with the Savory Collection. Michael, it's great to have you with us as well.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
Lauren Schoenberg, tell us the story. How did this incredible collection come to be?
There was a young man who went to Harvard University, dropped out, came to New York, got a gig, Tom, working in what they used to call a transcription service, and shortly put, nowadays, people record things off the air without even thinking about it. We have so much technology. In those days, if something you wanted to hear, like you said before, it was gone. It was evanescent, over the airs and gone. A transcription service would capture what was on the radio on a disc. And if you were a producer of a show or an artist or a sponsor, you would say to the transcription service, I want you to record the show this evening at 10 o'clock. Well, anyway, that was Bill Savory's gig. And in his off hours, he stayed. And on the other sides of the discs that had been discarded, he recorded eventually over 1,000 discs of the best jazz music of the day. And that's basically how it came to happen. I don't think he had any commercial potential in mind. I don't know, a lot of us as adolescents or young people, you know, we have this kind of obsessive interest in something. And he happened to have excellent taste.
Which means we can now listen back as though we were sitting there by the radio in the late 1930s or early 40s. Here's one from this collection. We're going to hear a lot in this hour, and we're so glad that you've made it available to us. Rockin' Chair with Mildred Bailey, and you'll hear the announcer very much of that time as he talks into the music.
All my boys and girls, and right now a girl you all know. She used to be a regular member of the band, but she hasn't been with us for nearly 4 years. Her name is, I'm sure you remember her name. And her signature, too.
Mildred Bailey in the rocking chair.
Oh, rocking chair, got me. Hang by my side. Chained to my rocking.
Lauren Schoenberg in New York. If that is not time travel, I don't know what is. Complete with all the static that came with it in those days and all the rest. What are you finding as you open up these crates?
We're finding tremendous things. I just want to tell you who that announcer was. That was none other than Paul Whiteman. And the way that I really see it is that every snippet of recordings from this collection is like another clue in a wonderful crossword puzzle of world history. Or maybe a better analogy would be, let's say we had a jigsaw puzzle and we thought the jigsaw puzzle was complete. Mm-hmm. It looked to be complete. Mm-hmm. And now we're finding out that there's another inch or two at the top that fits very clearly in, and now we understand in better context this thing that we thought was complete. These recordings, Tom, it's not as though people knew that they were there and we couldn't find them. It came as a tremendous surprise when we discovered them. This was thought to have been a treasure trove of Benny Goodman, which ain't bad because Benny had in his band all the great jazz artists.
People knew that that Savory had Goodman on hand in his crates. That's
right. Mm-hmm. But what we found when we opened them was all these other things, which is one of the reasons that I got in touch with Mike Cogswell, because we found some wonderful Louis Armstrong. And some of the Armstrong material had been out before in bad sound quality. And this is like what we found of Louis is really like finding a pristine negative of a photograph of your grandmother or grandfather, where all you had before was a very scratchy, hard to decipher version.
Michael Cogswell, you've listened to some of this, and we will hear more in this hour, and people will hear more rolling out in the months ahead, I'm sure. But, you know, this is not an era that we're unfamiliar with. It's not as though we've never heard recordings of the swing era. What's different about these recordings, Mike?
Well, the reason these recordings are so important, they're new performances that haven't been heard before. To discover new great Lester Young solos, it's like discovering a new Beethoven piano sonata. I mean, it's new information for the history of jazz. But what's also fascinating about these recordings, these are live performances. They're air checks. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes when jazz musicians go into the studio, they might hold back a little bit. You're making a record. The studio producer has his eye on the clock. Mm-hmm. The music you're performing is going to be your definitive statement. You don't want to screw it up. But when jazz musicians perform live, they tend to stretch out a little more, they explore a little more, and that's exactly what you hear on these recordings.
So not that bottled up, polished up, buttoned up studio sound, but the ties loosened in the moment, Lauren.
I was going to say, you know, there's a wonderful book on jazz by the late Whitney Balliot, who wrote for The New Yorker for many years, and it's called The Sound of Surprise. And the older I get and the more well, I'm a musician. Actually, Mike is a sax player, too.
Yeah.
The older I get, the more I realize that maybe what's so attractive about jazz, you know, it's not even the notes, it's not even the tunes. I think what it really is, I think it's the sense of discovery, the sense of joy, the sense of surprise, the sense of seeing people, adults or kids, who's ever playing jazz music, getting along together. And I think that, frankly, that's what's underneath all this. And here in the collection, Tom, I mean, not only do we have, you know, working bands, but like that band that you played, that you opened with, these guys may have jammed together at 4 a.m. in Chicago in 1929 or 1949.
Jack Teagarden, Bud Freeman, Louis Armstrong, Fats Waller, all that.
Well, and I'm going to tell you something else. In fact, I'm going to break this news today on point, because, you know, we're uncovering these things. We just yesterday, I was at the sound engineer, Doug Pomeroy, who is the wizard of this kind of restoration work. And I must mention that what you're hearing on these short selections that we're playing are unremastered, unfixed. These are the flat transfers the discs.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that's done, then we will go back and try and enhance the music without losing any of the over or undertones.
But, and if I can add a footnote to that, Doug Pomeroy is a genius. He's the guy to do this.
Yeah.
He did work for the Louis Armstrong House Museum with some Louis Armstrong acetates that we discovered, and he's phenomenal. For example, we had a missing couple of measures of music. He put it back in. I mean, he is the guy to do this project.
So it'll be cleaned up and lovely, but we're hearing kind of just the old school original today. Lauren, I want to get more on that, but I want this music in our ears. Here's a piece. This is 1940, and as far as this is Count Basie, Bugle Call Rag, and I think never aired since 1940. Hear it for the first time in more than half a century. Thank you. The Basie guys pretty loose that night in 1940. We get it right here today in 2010. And you were about to say, Lauren?
Yeah, I was about to say that we have a breaking news item from the Savory Archives, which is that, you know, that jam session with Louie and Fats Waller, as I mentioned, it was known for many years to exist in horrible sound. But we have just found a new jam session in pristine sound with Fats Waller, Eddie Condon, Zooty Singleton, Pee Wee Russell, Bud Freeman, Jack Teagarden. And this is one that wasn't known to exist and one that we thought we had in a very scratched up version. Doug Pomeroy. But just one thing I wanted to mention just real quick was something that makes this especially vibrant for me was I worked with a lot of these musicians. So on that last recording, I mean, I played with the drummer Joe Jones and that trumpet player Sweets Edison and jammed once with Freddie Green with Wynton Marsalis, which was very exciting.
And Benny Goodman, above all, you worked with.
Well, and so what I'm saying is, there's still those of us out there for whom this means a lot. And I know that, you know, Mike and his work at the Armstrong Archives, the Armstrong House, and the upcoming Armstrong Museum, you know, he's intimately involved with the folks who made this music. And I think, you know, Tom Brokaw who had the greatest generation?
Yes.
It's time that we do that for these people.
Well, you know, I mean, you guys were right there in that circle, but for millions of Americans, they're going to feel pretty intimately connected. We're going to hear a lot more of the Savory Archives in this hour. Lauren Schoenberg, please stand by, and Michael Cogswell, this is really a treat. We'll go out with Jumpin' at the Woodside, Count Basie, Lester Young, 1939. You're hearing it now again. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Join us. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about the Savory Archives, the Savory Recordings, a treasure trove of great late 30s jazz just pulled from deep obscurity. Lauren Schoenberg is with us. He is executive director of the National Jazz Museum in Harlem. He tracked them down and got hold of them, acquired them, and now we get to hear them as well. Michael Cogswell is with us, director of the Louis Armstrong House Museum in New York. You're welcome to join us, swing jazz fans. Is this your dream come true? Behind me right here, Benny Goodman, Lionel Hampton, Charlie Christian with Shivers, 1939, a recording that hadn't been heard for decades. Does it put you right back there, in the club, by the radio, 1939? Have you followed the fate of the Savory Archives? Did you think they would ever see the light of day again? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's go right to our callers. Joe in Norfolk, Virginia. Joe, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Todd, and guests. It's a pleasure to be on the program. You know, I'm a fan of jazz, but even more than that, this is such an exciting thing that we have these radio broadcasts from the 30s that were thought lost and now found. And I'm a radio collector. I have thousands of radio programs, and so many are gone or of low quality that I think this is wonderful. One question, are all the elements of a radio program on these discs, the announcer, the ID, the commercials, things like that?
Lauren?
Well, in some cases they are. In most cases they're not, because it was a very finite amount of time on these discs, and so Bill was an expert at cutting out the announcements. He would cut out vocals. He would do all these things. However, on some of them, yes, there are fascinating insights. The Coleman Hawkins broadcast ends with the announcer saying, "Live from the Fiesta Danceteria, New York's first self-service nightclub." I mean, on another one, Secretary of State Cordell Hull starts speaking in Iowa, and he says, you know, "My ladies and gentlemen," and then and it goes right into Count Basie. So there's little snippets of things.
You know, there's an example in here maybe we should listen to right now. Some of these have announcers, as you say, and some do not, and sometimes the announcer, I hope you can explain this Billie Holiday Strange Fruit recording for us, because the announcer, we all know that this was Billie Holiday singing about lynchings of black Americans back in that day, but the announcer's so kind of bizarrely upbeat. To your question, Joe, here's a little bit where there's an announcer and then just a little bit of a very stern, right at your heart, Billie Holiday.
Billie Holiday in person singing the song that is driving swingsters crazy as they play it over and over again on their phonographs. It has a very strange and haunting effect on most people. It's got me. So let's see if it will get you. Billie Holiday and Strange Fruit.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root.
Billie Holiday, 1939, with Strange Fruit. Lauren Michael, can you tell us the history here? I mean, there's Billie Holiday singing Blood on the Leaves and Blood at the Root, and we're talking about lynching, and you've got the announcer with that jaunty intro, you know, driving swingsters crazy. What's
well, you know, I think what you have to realize here, this is Lauren, but what I think you have to realize is, A commercial radio announcer in 1939 could not have said, now Billie's going to sing a tune that is not being allowed to be recorded on the major labels because it's about lynching. People were not going to say that. So that guy, can't blame him. He was reading his script. He had probably never heard the record before. So I think it's just all the more amazing that Bill Savory recorded it. And I have to say, at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem, where we're doing all of our public programming this month on Tuesday nights, our Jazz for Curious Listeners series around the Savory recordings, and on the 25th, we're actually going to have his son there, the legendary producer George Avakian, Larry Applebaum from the Library of Congress, Larry Roeder from the New York Times. We're going to actually get into this issue, Tom, that you're raising, because I think it's probably the most significant issue here.
I absolutely agree with Lauren on that. I've wondered about that since I first heard it. That announcer is so culturally tone deaf, and he probably did not know what was going to follow his announcement. He was making an announcement, ladies and gentlemen, here's the song that's driving audiences wild down in Greenwich Village. He didn't really know what was going to follow.
And corny Strange Fruit, like a kind of Boris Karloff.
I have to tell you something, because all three of us have done radio here. I can't jump on him at all, because he's a commercial guy. And he's reading a script.
Leaving that aside, and it's not really an attack on him. I mean, he just sounds weird next to the song. But there's enormous, not just musical, but there's enormous cultural and political information flowing through these recordings.
Well, that's – and now we've hit on the point. These recordings are much more than just hot jazz of the 1930s. They are, like jazz is, probably the best window – or one of the best windows into world history, and definitely into American history. And I think ultimately that's what we really have here in the Bill Savory collection, is a new, fresh insight. There are CBS News broadcasts about Hitler and the Sudetenland, and there's an FDR speech, and there's James Joyce, and there's all kinds of things, Tom, that contextualize the jazz recordings. And at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem, frankly, we're much more fascinated and dedicated to exploring the complete context as we are. I think that sentence construction I made just didn't add up.
But we get it. There's going to be a lot of learning here. Here's another. Never heard since 1939. You'll hear it right now from the Savory Archives. This is Sing, 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 Benny Goodman. We'll be right back. 1939, from the Savory Collection, Sing, Sing, Sing. And wow, Benny Goodman really sawing on that clarinet. Pete in Columbia, South Carolina. Pete, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty well.
Good. This is absolutely wonderful, these recordings that I'm hearing and I've been reading about. My interest is actually the copyright issues. Are they all to be released in their entirety due to copyright issues, which I've been reading about a little in the publicity that these recordings have made recently?
Great question. Lauren, what's the situation there? What is it clear? I mean, who owns something like this?
Well, that's the question of the moment. There's hearings going on in Congress just this month. You're probably reading about them, having to do with copyright, having to do with royalties and M&M and all different kinds of things. It's unresolved. And we're currently, I think it's fair to say, we have the best folks available to us, and we are researching it because my goal and the goal of the Jazz Museum is that ultimately all this material becomes available. It's not ours in that sense. It must be heard, and it all must be heard, and it all must be accessible. But we have to dot the I's and cross the T's. I just want to mention about that Sing, Sing, Sing real
yes,
quick,
please.
Tom. That was Lionel Hampton on the drums.
Oh.
People think of Lionel Hampton as a great
Benny on the clarinetist,
player.
On the clarinet?
Oh, yes, it was Benny on the clarinet, but it was Lionel Hampton
behind.
On the drums.
Wow. Mm.
And it's kind of funny because, you know, Benny played Sing, Sing, Sing so many times.
Mm-hmm.
And that particular recording is just one of the best solos. And also, it's interesting, you know, Lionel Hampton became famous as Louis Armstrong's drummer.
Yeah.
It's something that people don't know. So we intend to do a lot of programming with the Armstrong Archives, too, to kind of see all about this stuff. But to answer the caller's question, yes, it's a thorny issue, and we're deep into it. Right now, the only way to hear the stuff unedited in its entirety is to come to 104 East 126th Street, the National Jazz Museum in Harlem, because go ahead.
Well, nobody will know how to hear it. But I mean, I guess I really don't know something's played on the radio, somebody records it. Who owns that?
Well, that's a great question. Back in those days, let's say that Benny Goodman was under contract to a record company when he made that version of Sing, Sing, Sing. Those contracts that they signed at that time did not anticipate the other kinds of media usage that came later. So many times it won't be specified. And so it's a matter of a legal interpretation. Is the contract sacrosanct and complete in and of itself as of 1939? I mean, this is what Scalia's talking about, I guess, with mm-hmm. with the Supreme Court and being an originalist, you know? How do you look at these things,
right.
you know?
Right. And the rights and permissions can be so complicated because you have the musicians and you have their heirs. The musicians were under contract to record companies, as Lauren said. You have rights and permissions of the composers who compose the compositions.
Michael, you folks were part of putting out an incredible CD of Armstrong with material from the 1930s that you found in his archives. So, I mean, how was that dealt with?
It was dealt with through the Armstrong estate, through the company that created the radio broadcast,
mm-hmm.
and then the record company set funds aside in escrow just in case somebody comes out and says, look, mm-hmm. you know, I'm a stakeholder in this broadcast as well.
Did they try and anticipate payments to the Sidemen too, or just Armstrong? Mm-hmm. Like if I played drums in his band, would his great-grandson have a right to come up and say my granddad was the drummer?
Right. That's something that the record company took care of. You know, the lawyers for the record company lined all that up. Because I know that Lauren's been very good about this, that being a professional musician himself,
mm-hmm.
the musicians deserve to be paid for their work. And, yes, we want the world to hear these recordings. That's part of Lauren's mission at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem. This should be available. But at the same time, he's going to do right by all the musicians and their heirs.
Lauren, we hope you figure out how to cut through and make this happen. Here's one I really loved. I mean, this has been out a performance that's, I guess, been out in bootleg before. But here from the Savory Collection, this is Fats Waller, one of my favorites, 1938, Honeysuckle Rose, announcer voice coming in again, and then Fats.
Fats doing a little Honeysuckle. We've got a minute and a half, and I certainly would like to get it in if you think it's possible. It is. Of course, Fats doing it down at the Yacht Club all the time.
1938, and it has to be Fats Waller walking that keyboard down at the Yacht Club all the time, says the announcer. Jay, south of Louisville, Kentucky. Jay, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. What a wonderful show, and what a wonderful treasure that your co-host has. My grandfather, the late Elmer Gibson, used to have a radio station in Northern California, originally from Santa Cruz, I guess, you know, resided eventually in Vallejo.
Okay.
But his brother, my great uncle, was Senator Luther Gibson, who was a state senator for 15 years, I think from 40 to 55.
Yeah.
But my grandfather was a DJ. And my mom told stories of, you know, coming home every day from school and seeing a stack of LPs, you know, pink vinyl records that would be on his doorstep or on their doorstep from all different record labels. And this was, of course, you know, Benny Goodman, Duke Ellington, Cap Calloway, the Dorseys, you name them.
Now, Jay, were they really LPs or were they all the way back in the 78 era?
Oh, no, those they were 78.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry if I said that wrong. But it was pink vinyl. And my grandfather notoriously preserved over 10,000 before he passed away. And, of course, it was auctioned off to a collector in San Francisco for his long-term care. But nevertheless, he would put the record to the needle one time and then, therefore, you know, record it on reel-to-reel. And then that was his master that he used for his radio show, as well as, you know, making cassettes or any other, you know, copies.
Wow.
that he saw fit. But I'm sure, you know, I know these are radio recordings and live performances, which is, you know, the utmost treasure because, once again, I guess these recordings are the master themselves. But, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of other, you know, people out there, you know, in America who have, you know, held on to and retained some very fascinating recordings that may be, you know, in limited, you know, editions or that.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if there were other rare records out there?
Yes. No question that they've got to be. It's tracking them down. I mean, it's a wonderful family story, Jay. Just fantastic. Mm-hmm. And the idea of them then later paying for your, for Elmer Gibson's care is pretty terrific. I'm so glad you called, Jay. I mean, Lauren, it must make you, you've got one treasure trove already. There, it sounds like another must make you salivate to hear about those rare ones.
Absolutely. And I don't think there could be a better legacy for Bill Savory than it helped find other collections around the world. You know, I just want to mention there's two folks whose names haven't come up who are very important here. One is Bill Savory's son, Gene Savory of Malta, Illinois, who actually saved these records from the dustbin. Bill died. People were put in charge of moving the estate around. And at one point, he got a phone call. There's these old boxes of your dad's old records. Yeah. And we're just going to toss them. And Gene is the one who not only did that, but brought them back to his home and preserved them in his living room. I mean, there were so many of them. And also, frankly, we could not have acquired them without a very generous board member named Jonathan Scheuer, who actually made it possible to purchase them from the Savory estate. And these are two folks whose names don't get mentioned enough because we wouldn't have the records if it wasn't for
And to give credit where credit is due also, Lauren has worked so hard on this for
years.
Probably more than 20 years, 30 years. So this didn't just drop out of the sky. It was a fruit of 30 years of cultivation to find these records. They've been legendary in the jazz world for years, and Lauren was persistent enough to get them.
We're going to come back and hear more of that story and more of this wonderful music from the Savory recordings. Lauren Schoenberg is with us from the National Jazz Museum in Harlem, and Michael Cogswell from the Louis Armstrong House Museum in New York. Behind us here, Mildred Bailey, 1935 from the Savory recordings. You can join us. Can you hear the live in the groove buoyancy here of Count Basie, Lester Young, Fats Waller, Mildred Bailey, 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
It didn't take long before the hi-hats were doing it Park Avenue and it all over town. You see them scuffling, shuffling, trucking along.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about recordings from the Savory Archive just rescued. Here's Teddy Wilson with Love Me or Leave Me, not heard on air since 1941. a treasure trove of great late 30s, early 40s jazz just pulled up from deep obscurity by Lawrence Schoenberg with the National Jazz Museum in Harlem. He joins us today from New York, as does Michael Cogswell, director of the Louis Armstrong House Museum. You can join us. Swing jazz fans, is this your dream come true? Is this like time travel, like you are there, 1938, 1939, 1941? What, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. And Lauren, I guess I should ask you first exactly how Bill Savory did this. I mean, one thing that sets this apart is he wasn't, recording of all kinds was much more difficult in those days, but this wasn't out of somebody's garage. He had great recording equipment to do it, and acetate and aluminum. How did that work?
Well, contrary to popular conception, recording techniques were very sophisticated back in the 1930s. The problem was that people at home didn't have good players.
Right, no cassette, no reel-to-reel.
Right, but even in 78, their player and their home speakers weren't great. Mm-hmm. But if you could listen to the music of the 30s in the 30s on great equipment, it would have sounded as good as anything recorded today. So what he had was access to direct line transcriptions. What I mean by that, Tom, is that he was at a transcription studio that had a direct radio line, direct from the radio station, into the console, mm-hmm. into the turntable. Mm-hmm. And he had 10-inch discs, 12-inch discs, and 16-inch discs that they could record at any speed they wanted. They were already recording at 33 and a third in those days, at 78. Sometimes he'd record at 80. Sometimes he'd record at 49 and a half, if that's the speed that he needed. He was much more than just a recording engineer. That's like calling Thomas Edison a guy who fiddled around with light bulbs or something. Bill Savory was into sound, into parabolic waves. He eventually wound up working for defense contractors. He lived in Falls Church, Virginia.
Mm-hmm. He was into rumor of CIA connection at the end.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's way beyond a rumor. Mm-hmm. He was into all kinds of stuff. And so what we really see here in terms of this being a great American story is the story of Bill Savory. And who was he? And what does this say about him? And what does it say about American culture? I mean, when you started playing that recording of Teddy Wilson's Love Me or Leave Me, you know, Teddy Wilson became famous originally as Louis Armstrong's piano player. And I was immediately transported into that world of Louis and Bix and Bunny and Fats and Benny Goodman. That recording that we played, actually, that one was not a radio broadcast. That was Teddy Wilson's trio helping Bill Savory get some sounds going in his new Chicago studio. So they came in and played so Bill could fiddle with the equipment.
Hmm. And there he was, and you finally winkled it out. I can't get enough of this. 1940, here's Coleman Hawkins, Body and Soul. Coleman Hawkins, Body and Soul. And Lauren, by the time we get late in that little bit, he's getting way out there. We're hearing, I don't know, it sounds like shades of what would come later after swing.
Well, that's an example of what we were talking about earlier, that Coleman Hawkins' 1939 Body and Soul is justly famous and studied by saxophone players and memorized. But here's a live performance, what, 6-7 months later, in which he's really stretching out.
And, you know, who made the first jazz recording of Body and Soul? Louis Armstrong. Mm. But what's really interesting is, Tom, I want to mention this. We played this. We're doing our Tuesday evenings this month up in Harlem on these recordings. Mm-hmm. So we had couple hundred people showed up and
great
playing this version Tuesday night, and as he's playing, I look in the door of the museum, well, our visitor center, and there's this young, brilliant pianist named Sullivan Fortner, who just came back from Europe. He's a young, brilliant cat. And he hears the Coleman Hawkins record, and he goes over to the piano, and while everybody was listening to that record, he started playing the piano along with the Coleman Hawkins record. So we faded out the Coleman Hawkins record, and then he played a bit, and then we faded up the Coleman Hawkins record, and he played with it. The reason I tell that anecdote is that at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem, we're really dedicated to taking these recordings and making them live and making them be fodder for 2010, for 2020, for young artists coming up. We don't want to be like we discovered King Tut's tomb and our heads are in the sand and our rear ends are up in the air. So to make a long story short, this material becomes all the more significant when it's not pitched to the swing fans of the past or some kind of, you know, musically onanistic experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you want to talk about great piano. I loved this one. Here's another. I don't think this has been aired yet either since the collection came to light, since you brought it to light. But here is Art Tatum, the great Art Tatum. This is 1945. Just listen to the piano here. I'm beginning to see the light. Tatum, 1945, now back with us from the National Jazz Museum's a savory archive. David in Norfolk, Virginia. David, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, thanks. I first just really want to thank Lauren and everybody who's involved with this. I'm a huge jazz fan, and although I like contemporary jazz, but I love older jazz too. And I just wanted to say I'm a librarian in a public library in Norfolk, Virginia, and I can't wait to get the chance to add these recordings to our jazz CD collection. We have a great jazz collection, and I'd love to be able to get these into our collection. And also, I have a question. I haven't really followed the story closely enough to know, but are there any recordings of Charlie Christian included in this discovery?
David, thanks. Lauren, I think we heard a little Charlie Christian already here, but what about it?
Yes, there are, and there are new ones. There's ones that we didn't know existed. They're not listed anywhere. They're coming up all the time. I just heard one the other day of a version of I Surrender Dear recorded at the Coconut Grove with the Goodman Sextet, and that has not been heard before. There's a new Flying Home. So, yes, there is new Charlie Christian. But I'd say probably the greatest discoveries in terms of quality and quantity might be Lester Young. There's probably more new Lester Young that we didn't know about. And, of course, Benny Goodman and his musicians. But the most startling moments that I've had so far have really come from some of the Lester Young and Herschel Evans and Coleman Hawkins and Fats Waller and Louis Armstrong.
What happened to these discs over the years, Lauren, as they were out of sight? Bill Savory held them very tight. Where were they? What kind of condition were they in when you finally got hold of them?
When I finally got them, they were in Gene Savory's living room and house in Malta, Illinois. And in Bill's later years, I think these things had been moved to a garage in Virginia. Mm-hmm. And they had suffered some serious decomposition, mold and mildew and all that kind of stuff. But we found them, and we weren't exactly wearing hazmat materials. We probably should have. I mean, the National Institute of Health should probably get some of these boxes. Yeah. But what was important is what was inside.
1,000 discs. How many hours does that mean?
Well, I'll put it this way. We're through 1/5. We've transferred 1/5 to digital. And that 1/5 has filled up about 20 70-minute CDs. So I guess that would be well over 100 hours.
You drove them back to New York in a rented truck from Malta.
I had Scott Wenzel and Kevin Cerevich with me, a wonderful musician and another great jazz historian guy. And we got in a Penske truck, no plug intended, and drove back thinking the whole way, oh my gosh, I hope we don't get a flat tire.
Of those nearly 1,000 discs, how many were in condition that you're going to be able to, save and use the music on them?
Well, I'd say 25% are in the condition, like, let's say, the Fats Waller items that you played or the Coleman Hawkins. 50% are in the middle and are definitely salvageable. Mm-hmm. And the other 25% are pretty bad. But I will tell you, there are some in that lower 25% that are some of the most remarkable things. You know, the Armstrong folks put out this version of Louis Armstrong playing along with an Italian singer's record. And Louis plays the trumpet with it. And the sound quality might not be the best in the world, but I'll tell you, every time I hear that record, tears come to my eyes. And when I think about what we're going to do with this material, we'll also issue some of the material that sounds not wonderful. But again, it just, tears will come to your eyes because it's so beautiful.
Here's another new one, come to light, thanks to Lauren and the Savory Collection. This is the Bunny Berrigan Blues, 1938. Berrigan, jazz trumpeter, and there, a little bit of a singer as well. Michael, Lauren, what do you hear when your ears go to that recording?
Well, that was Slam Stewart. And the way Slam played the bass was he played the bass and he sang along in unison. But I want to mention, do you know what that really is? Mm. That's like if we found a film of when Satchel Paige and his players played against the Yankees or played with the Yankees. You know, we hear legendary things that in the days of segregated baseball, these guys did play together on occasion and let the chips fall where they may. That record session is the musical example of that, in a sense, because that is an integrated band. In fact, that's a mostly black band with one white musician. Most of the integration in those days was usually the white folks being beneficent or, you know, having a couple of black players in a white band. These were some of the greatest African-American jazz players of all time, the Jimmy Lunsford Band, the John Kirby Band, Slim and Slam, with Bunny Berrigan in the middle of it. So let's say that's like hearing Babe Ruth fill in one of the great black baseball teams of the 30s. It's an incredible American moment.
Michael Cogswell, are you getting your eyes opened here? I mean, you know this era as well as anybody, and yet here comes this new treasure trove.
It is ear-opening. I've heard just a small fraction of these recordings from going to the National Jazz Museum in Harlem, and it's so exciting. And we're especially eager to find what's next in that box that Lauren and Doug Pomeroy are going through.
And we want to do some, frankly, we would love to do some programming with you at the Armstrong House and the Armstrong Archive mutually on this.
Hey, we got it all going on. Scott in Lancaster, South Carolina. Scott, you're on the air.
Yeah, just a quick question. I know you said at the beginning of the show he was using discarded discs to record this, and I'm wondering anything interesting you found on the A-sides.
Absolutely. We have found speeches of the Secretary of State. We have found FDR. And we found, frankly, and not to be condescending to the material that's not jazz material. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of fascinating stuff. We had some folks up from Philadelphia who made an appointment to come to the museum and hear some of the material. And I was showing them some of the discs. And in one of the discs is a transcription of the Popeye radio show from 1939. And we took the disc out. And inside, there was a 16-inch transcription, were radio scripts from the 30s. They'd just been tossed in there. Plus, I'll bet you folks who are interested in the history of broadcasting and the history of engineering, because Savory was such a brilliant trap with this stuff. We have many discs of, waves and sound waves and all kinds of stuff. So there might be some professor right now who's going, ah.
Right. Hear it.
My God.
Gasp. Let's hear a little more. Bugle Call Rag, 1938, Savory Collection, Cab Calloway. We'll be right back. I love picturing the settings, Lauren. You said sometimes just for the radio, but other times in this era, of course, they were in clubs. They were in performance centers with the radio material set up, and coming right back through us, it brings the whole setting to life as well.
You're absolutely right. In fact, Tom, the great majority of this material was not done in a studio. The great majority is at the nightclub. There's one of Louis Jordan's band where the announcer says, you know, live from the Elks Rendezvous in Harlem. You said at the beginning of the broadcast, Tom, that it's like a musical time capsule. And there's a way to listen to this that places you in the Apollo with Benny Carter, in the Manhattan Room with Benny Goodman, at the Cotton Club with Louis Armstrong. You're absolutely right. I mean, that's where the bulk of the stuff is from.
Tell us again about how people can hear this at the National Jazz Museum, Lauren.
Well, the National Jazz Museum in Harlem is at 104 East 126th Street. And our website is www.jmhi.org. And to make a long story short, we're doing all of our Tuesday evening programming, which is our free for listeners programming on the museum. And if you go to our website, you'll find out a lot more about it, frankly. And it's been so much fun sharing this.
Oh, absolutely. Listeners, you can also hear samples from the Savory Collection at onpointradio.org and check out everything that the National Jazz Museum in Harlem has to offer. Michael Cogswell, the Louis Armstrong House Museum, who's been in there listening already, we're so grateful to you for being with us this hour, Michael. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your interest.
And Lauren Schoenberg, National Jazz Museum in Harlem, thanks for bringing all this to light. Great to have you, Lauren.
My pleasure.
We'll go out with I Got Rhythm, 1938, from the Savory Archive. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.